It's a world-scale resource. It's a long way from market, and it needs to compete into the U.S. market.
Considering future prospects for Alaska's natural gas. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 29th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new approach to helping homeless inebriates in Fairbanks.
If we provide housing plus the services necessary to sustain people, things succeed remarkably well.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
TransCanada Corporation says despite the discovery of massive amounts of natural gas and shale in the lower 48, it still sees an Alaska gas pipeline as a priority. TransCanada's Senior Vice President of Business Development, Dennis McConaughey, told the U.S. Senate Energy Committee yesterday that the timeline for marketing Alaska's gas still works out.
So we very much are of the view that Alaska is a component of this, notwithstanding the significant, quote, game-changing advent of the shale gas resource, so that it's very much a case that we need both of these resources coming into the U.S. supply mix. And of course, in the case of Alaska, it is going to take us probably most of the rest of the next decade to realize that. But we certainly do not ascribe to a view of crowding out.
McConaughey told the committee TransCanada is on track to have an open season next year, the next step in building an Alaska pipeline. He says they hope to see a price level in the next few years, somewhere in the $6 to $8 range, which he believes can happen with Alaska's natural gas in the mix. The president of BP America, Lamar McKay, says he mostly agreed with McConaughey. BP is planning a competing gas line from the North Slope.
It's a world-scale resource. It's a long way from market, and it needs to compete into the U.S. market, but I would agree generally with his comments.
Wednesday's hearing tackled natural gas's role in climate change legislation. Leaders in the gas industry from companies like BP warned that they need help making sure gas is part of the nation's transition away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy goals. McKay says he's concerned natural gas will be left behind in climate change legislation being considered by Congress.
Now, we support a national climate policy that creates a level playing field for all forms of energy that produce carbon emissions. In pending legislation, the playing field is not level. In spite of its economic and environmental benefits, gas is being squeezed out of the power sector by mandates for increased use of alternatives and protection of high-carbon coal generation.
McKay says BP supports financial incentives for alternative fuels, and he might even support incentives to kickstart the phased retirement of the nation's least efficient and most carbon-intense coal-fired plants. He says natural gas could replace them. The Energy Information Administration, which does independent analysis through the Energy Department, says under the climate bill recently passed by the U.S. House, natural gas use may initially boom. But EIA head Richard Newell says by 2020, it could go either way, and use might taper off.
Actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions would tend to increase the attractiveness of electricity generation using natural gas relative to conventional coal generation. However, although generation using natural gas produces less greenhouse gas emissions than generation using conventional coal, it produces more emissions than generation using renewable energy or nuclear power, which are emissions-free.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is the top Republican on the Senate Energy Committee and urged her colleagues to see natural gas as part of a move to domestic energy independence and a way to reduce greenhouse gases. Governor Parnell says he's still optimistic about the completion of a gas line from the North Slope to North American markets. He said he's been meeting with companies that could use the project, and he doesn't see any reason for changing the statutory terms at this point. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Parnell discounts recent reports of too much natural gas available in the lower 48 and speculation that new shale gas finds and increased liquefied natural gas imports could spell the end of hopes for getting Alaska's gas to market. He says he anticipates a successful industry response to both the state's AGIA project and the BP ConocoPhillips Denali pipeline when they go before possible shippers next year in what is called the open season.
It's easy to throw out sound bites about this isn't going to work, but unless you're in those chairs or in these chairs on the state side working with experts on what can work, it's hard to, for me to give that line any credence. So I'm upbeat about our prospects.
Parnell doesn't see getting complete acceptance of the project in next year's open season, however. He measures success if shippers bid with specific conditions attached that could be met.
When a company or companies show up at open season to say, we'll put our gas in subject to certain conditions, that opens up the opportunity for those companies to negotiate with a pipeline company over terms. And, I mean, frankly, would the state like to see an open season with no conditions? Of course, but that doesn't happen in the real world. And I wouldn't want to set that expectation.
Parnell says the oil companies he's talked with still say they want fiscal certainty, a stable tax regime, in place before they'll participate in the line. However, he says he's offering economic stability instead. He's not ready to open the subject of taxes, but he is ready to listen to ideas. The companies have not yet asked for any specific statutory changes on the project or on taxes. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska's Republican Congressman Don Young says the health care bill proposed by House Democrats today is expensive and won't give Americans better health insurance. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California unveiled Democrats' $894 billion package on the steps of the U.S. Capitol today. It would expand Medicaid and includes a government insurance option. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said in a preliminary report that the bill would trim more than $100 billion from projected budget deficits over the next decade. But Representative Young says the price tag is too steep.
It is still a very expensive bill, and I don't see anything in the bill that will lower the cost of health care. They never addressed the administration cost. They haven't done what we should be doing. And it looks like there's going to be a tax, there'd be a surtax on small businesses. There will be an employer mandate that they have to have insurance. If they don't, they get fined.
Small businesses would be exempt from the employer mandate if their payroll is under $500,000 annually. That's a higher threshold than Democrats originally proposed. Bill sponsors lowered its cost by stripping out increases in Medicare payments to doctors, which is in a separate bill. Democrats say the health care proposal would give insurance coverage to more than 35 million people. It would let the government negotiate drug prices for Medicare beneficiaries and would require most American citizens to get health insurance. Congressman Young says there are some elements in the bill he approves of.
There are some things in there that are good. When the original H.R. 3200 came out, it deauthorized the Indian Health Care Improvements Act. And this we reauthorize it. So that's good for Alaskans and the amount of money that's going to be in there for that. So that part is good. But abortions are still in there, paid for by tax dollars, and that's not good, and that may kill the bill because there's people that are on the other side of the aisle that think this should never have been put in there.
Young says he doesn't think Democrats have the votes needed to pass the bill in its current form, but he also doubts they'll allow Republicans to introduce any amendments. The public option included in the bill is considered to be a compromise among Democrats. Liberal House members wanted the public option to create reimbursement rates based on Medicare. But instead, House Speaker Pelosi's version says the federal government can negotiate rates with providers, much like insurance companies currently do. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, threats of legal action to push for Cook Inlet beluga habitat protection.
The agency just hasn't been showing the urgency to protecting this critically imperiled species that it deserves and that by law it's entitled to.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
A Federal Housing Authority official was in Alaska this week advocating for a unique approach to serving homeless inebriates that's been successful in the Lower 48. Paul Carlson with the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness held sessions with state and local representatives in Anchorage and Fairbanks. Carlson works with communities to develop 10-year plans to cope with the issue. He says a concept known as Housing First is the agency's primary strategy.
It's really kind of a basic and obvious proposition, really, that the solution for a person who's in a housing crisis or homeless is obviously get them a home. Now, you don't end there, but you certainly start there. But what we did in the past, of course, was try to train them prior to getting the housing and make them go through a lot of hoops, and then housing was somehow a reward for good behavior. And we learned that when we take that approach, it didn't really work, and homelessness gets worse and worse.
Carlson says the problems homeless alcoholics are dealing with are better addressed once they have a safe place to live.
And if we reverse that process, actually start with providing housing. Now, it doesn't mean it's only housing. But if we provide housing plus the services necessary to sustain people, get people into drug and alcohol recovery, mental health care, domestic violence support, but we start with housing and then add those services, things succeed remarkably well.
The Housing First approach was developed by a New York City researcher a decade ago, and Carlson says long-term studies conducted on Lower 48-based programs have proven it works.
When we just put people in housing, like we had control groups for this, and provided no services, we had predictably very little success. 15, 20, 25%. The rest of them blew out of the housing pretty quickly. You add the services, and even with your long-term, in effect, especially with your long-term chronic public inebriates who are homeless on the streets, your long-term people with long-term and chronic mental illness who are also homeless on the streets, the statistics reverse. It goes up to these remarkable success rates of 75, 80, 85, even 90% people not only getting into housing, but sustaining that past the first year and beyond.
Carlson says the housing programs have behavior guidelines, but allow participants to continue to drink while they live in the apartments. That's gotten them labeled as bunks for drunks. But Jeff Jesse, Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, says the concept is a better alternative to how Alaska communities currently deal with street alcoholics.
The government is spending a lot of money right now to keep these people homeless and keep them in the community where they're drinking anyway. So in essence, it's really, there's no free option available to the community. You're either going to pay by using your police force and the emergency room and the jail, or you're going to provide them some safe place to be where you can manage the environment and minimize the impact to the community.
Jesse says the authorities recently sent a delegation to visit a Housing First facility in Seattle and was impressed. The Seattle program has a high rate of client retention and reduction in drinking. It also saves that city about $4 million in law enforcement and other costs. Jesse says a small-scale pilot program is happening in Anchorage and that the Mental Health Trust and state and federal government are ready to support other projects as long as they're community-driven. Fairbanks Downtown Association Director David Vandenberg, who organized yesterday's meeting in Fairbanks, says city property and business owners are interested.
That's their gut response to this, is that there's got to be a solution that we can get to through housing. So I think that there's a good number of people who already are kind of there, that housing can furnish a big part of the solution, that we're constantly kind of chasing our tails trying to manage this population.
The city of Fairbanks has an estimated homeless population of anywhere between 30 to 100, depending on the season. Director of the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living, Brenda Stanfill, who also attended yesterday's meeting, says homelessness and alcohol are major issues for her clients.
If you're a homeless woman out on the streets, your rates of sexual assault, your chance of being sexually assaulted is tremendously high. If you're a victim of domestic violence, you end up at some point in time being homeless because you can't stay in your home any longer due to the abuse. So it's definitely something that we have to address, have to look at in order of addressing the issues we primarily serve.
Stanfield's agency may be the avenue for pursuing a housing first approach in Fairbanks. She says the Interior Center for Nonviolent Living recently received a grant from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to hire a homeless liaison coordinator to engage the community and develop a 10-year plan for better dealing with the issue in Fairbanks. Southeast Alaska communities are being asked to foot the bill for a survey of second growth timber in the Tongass National Forest. The Juneau Assembly got the ball rolling recently when it promised $10,000. The tree survey is estimated to cost $80,000. It will help Southeast's struggling timber industry make the transition from old growth to new. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Alaska Forest Association Director Owen Graham says trees grow like people, only they live a lot longer, and the teenage years are very long.
When they're little kids, they grow slow, and then when they reach teenagers' age, you know, like 25 to 100 for a tree, they grow really fast, and then they slow down and basically become mature after about 100 years.
Most of the hemlock, spruce, and cedar in the Tongass National Forest are centuries old. About 450,000 acres of the 17-million-acre forest are new growth in areas that have been logged. Approximately a third of the young trees are planned for future harvest. The question is, when are they ready to cut? Southeast Conference started looking for the answer a couple of years ago. The Association of Panhandle Communities hired a timber appraiser who put together a preliminary report and estimated a complete inventory would cost $80,000. Director Shelley Wright says the organization couldn't afford to continue.
We had to drop the ball last year and not complete the study. But if they do get money from the state, if other communities do pledge money and we manage to get the $80,000, Southeast Conference will be the lead on the study.
The idea of community funding came up at a recent Tongass Futures Roundtable. This collaborative group represents the diverse users of the nation's largest forest. One goal is a timber supply for existing mills. But the industry is being pressured to cut fewer old trees. Since it takes about 100 years on average for Tongass trees to grow to maturity, the mills need to know when they can make the transition from old growth to young. State Forester Chris Mace says some of the young trees are pushing 60 to 80 years old, but the majority are less than 40. The inventory would define the age classes and where they are in the forest, as well as whether the stands have been pre-commercially thinned. Mace says that should take place when the forest is 15 to 20 years old.
What that does is it concentrates the remaining growth on the stems that are left, so you don't have the trees competing with each other. It adds diameter to the trees quite a bit quicker.
The Forest Association's Graham says the industry wants to convert some Tongass acres to young growth management. That's because trees grow faster, are more uniform, and have fewer defects. But age is the key.
If you cut the trees before they're fully mature, you can provide some saw logs for the sawmills. But on the other hand, it takes a lot more acres because you're cutting those trees right during the middle of their fast growth period. What a traditional forester likes to see is let the maximum growth take place, because then you can manage your forest on the fewest acres.
Mace says the Tongass inventory would tell foresters how much young growth will come online every decade over the next 80 years.
And that really will tell you when enough volume comes online, you can really make a judgment then of when you can transition the industry out of old growth and fully into young growth. And there'll be a transition period where you're doing a little of both for a period of time. But most of the mills have to retool to operate on a smaller log. So there's some investment decisions that need to be made by the industry.
Mace says the state will contribute to the cost of the inventory. Southeast Conference Director Wright says the money is to be held by the organization until enough is collected to hire a private timber appraiser who would consult with the Forest Service on the inventory. Graham hopes a contract can be written yet this fall, so crews are in the forest next spring, and the second growth survey is done by the end of summer. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Center for Biological Diversity is preparing to sue the federal government to force a critical habitat designation for the Cook Inlet beluga. The whale is listed under the Endangered Species Act. The center's Brendan Cummings says by law, the National Marine Fisheries Service should have proposed critical habitat a year ago.
The Cook Inlet beluga has been listed as endangered for over a year, and we still do not have a final critical habitat rule, much less even a proposed rule. Now, the agency is working on a proposed rule, and that rule we should hopefully see within a few weeks. But unfortunately, the agency just hasn't been showing the urgency to protecting this critically imperiled species that it deserves and that by law it's entitled to.
Cummings says it's frustrating to have to use the courts to force agencies to meet Endangered Species Act deadlines. He says the federal government should be able to follow its own laws. A government study earlier this month found that Cook Inlet belugas continue to decline. Their numbers have slipped to 321 animals, down from an estimated 375. The cause of the decline is not known, but Cummings says establishing critical habitat is fundamental for helping the species recover.
Studies have shown that species with critical habitat are more than twice as likely to be stable or increasing than species without.
Cummings calls the beluga an umbrella species for the health of Cook Inlet.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
Alaska state troopers say they can't determine how a Washington state woman fell off a cruise ship near Juneau. Amber Malko disappeared from the Zandam in early August while the ship was sailing from Juneau to Glacier Bay. Searchers found the 45-year-old woman's body on the west side of Douglas Island near the capital city. Holland America cruise officials said the death appeared to be a suicide, but troopers said the incident needed investigation. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the agency has not been able to determine how the woman ended up in the water.
There's been a lot of speculation from the public and from a lot of people in general going back and forth between, well, was it a suicide or did she jump? Was it accidental? And really that has been undetermined. It's a possibility that it could have been any one of those things, but at this point in time, evidence doesn't specifically point to what actually took place.
She says security tapes and autopsy reports did not help clarify the situation. She's heard no discussion of foul play. Malko was reported missing by a traveling companion when the cruise ship arrived in Glacier Bay about 75 miles northwest of Juneau on August 3rd. She was last seen when she ordered room service the previous night. A second cruise ship passenger disappearance September 22nd was ruled a suicide. Edelgard Carney of California was reported missing from the Sapphire Princess between Ketchikan and Vancouver. Royal Canadian Mounted Police said surveillance tapes showed her jumping from the ship near Bella Bella, British Columbia, about 200 miles south of the Alaska border. Mounted Police said the 67-year-old woman had been suffering from serious medical problems. Her body was not recovered despite searches by Canada's Coast Guard. Cultural education should be a top priority for young Alaskans in and out of school. That's the message from Tlingit Haida and other education advocates at the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood's recent convention in Juneau. They say young people who learn their heritage and traditions have a better chance of graduating and are more likely to avoid risky behavior. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
The Reverend Michael Alexa uses a sports metaphor to illustrate the difficulty of cross-cultural communications in education.
In one culture, everybody plays football. That's the only game you know. When you say play ball, it means football. Another culture is like playing a completely different ball game. It's as if in this other culture, they play only basketball. Now, what we do in Alaska today is we put both teams on the same playing field and say, have fun. You wind up with tackle basketball. The behaviors in one are inappropriate in the other.
And that, he says, is what's going on in many schools. Teachers don't know who they're teaching, and students don't understand what they're expected to learn. Many lose interest and drop out. Some turn to alcohol and drugs or commit suicide. The Russian Orthodox priest and cross-cultural communications expert says students have a better chance of succeeding if they know where they come from. So do their teachers. Having a traditional name helps. University of Alaska Southeast Admissions Director Joe Nelson says name-giving gives young people a connection to their past.
We have kids in every one of our villages who don't have a name. And they go through their lives not having a name. That, to me, is right up there, borderline criminal, if we want to look at our obligation to our kids and our people and our survival.
Nelson was one of the speakers on a cultural education panel at the ANBANS convention. He was joined by university students who introduced themselves in Tlingit or Haida, including their names or lineage. Joe Yates studies in the university's Native Teachers Program. He says he could only say thank you in Haida before he became involved.
Because before that, I didn't know my name was Watsase. Before that, I didn't know that I belonged to the Aklanis tribe, the Delphin Killer Whale tribe. I did not know my grandmother even had a name or my mother had a name. I really do hope that Native Oratory keeps on going because it helped me out so much.
He and others cited a Native Students Club, scholarships, and support from instructors and communities for their continued involvement. Jacqueline Tagabon runs the university program called Preparing Indigenous Teachers and Administrators for Alaska Schools.
What we really need to do that will create a systemic change is get our people back in there as teachers. It's wonderful and beautiful, and I've seen lots of circumstances and situations where we have non-Native teachers that stay and make that community a part of their life and become a part of our family, and I love that. That's beautiful to see. But the guarantee is when we have our people there in the classrooms.
Alexa, the Orthodox priest, says that has to be part of the public education system. He advocates intensive culture-based training for teachers before they begin work in villages, and he says parents, grandparents, and other community members should help out in the schools.
Should we hire somebody else? An anthropologist from Dartmouth? From Yale? From Princeton? Who's the expert in Tlingit culture? Who knows the Tlingit stories? Who speaks the Tlingit language? Tlingit people do, huh? We don't need a third party. We need to be involved. We need to take a stand. We need to save our kids.
Before adjourning, ANB and ANS delegates called for the state to re-examine its curriculum to better include Native students' needs and learning styles. They also asked that school staff be better trained in the culture and traditions of the part of the state where they work. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks and Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.